Hi, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, and we are going to have an absolutely fascinating hour. I spent a good part of dinner table conversation talking about this documentary, which airs on National Geographic this coming Sunday at 8 o'clock Central Time, The Human Family Tree. We already know that regardless of our race or nationality or religion, all of us can trace our ancient origin back to the cradle of humanity, which is East Africa. That was 60,000 years ago. What did our collective journey look like? Where did it take your specific ancestors during that time? And at what point in our past did we first cross paths with strangers who were living in our neighborhood? Science helps us shed light on these questions with an incredible experiment on a single day, on a single street, with the DNA of just a couple hundred random people. And the street was in Queens, one of the most diverse places in the world. National Geographic set out to trace the ancestral footsteps of all humanity and reveal through this diverse community just how interconnected we really are. Spencer Wells is featured in this wonderful National Geographic special, geneticist and explorer in residence, and he has been working over the past 4 years with the Genographic Project's international team. He's traveled to every corner of the world collecting and analyzing DNA samples from diverse human populations for their research, and they have had 350,000 people all over the world participate in this so far, and we'll give you a chance to figure out how you can participate as well. I'm ready to sign up. He's a leading population geneticist, and he says that the Genographic Project represents the ultimate marriage of his two great passions, biology and history. He is spearheading the Genographic Project, calling it a dream come true. Started his process of discovery when he was just 16 years old. He pursued his PhD at Harvard, and he, in 1994, conducted postdoctoral training at Stanford. And it was there that he became committed to studying genetic diversity in indigenous populations and unraveling age-old mysteries about early human migration. Well, welcome. Phone calls for Spencer. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and we have that email address you can use as well, and that is talk@wpr.org. Hi, Spencer.
Hi, Kathleen. Wow, what an introduction. I have anything else to say.
I think you have a lot to say. It is such an incredibly fascinating program. Sign us up. Sign all of us up. Let's become part of this.
Well, go ahead and swab your cheek.
I will, believe me, after this. Wait, tell me when you and other people in your field really began to unravel this human mystery of how we went where we went and how we're related. What clue did you have that you wanted to do this kind of incredible discovery?
Well, it's really only been with the advent of DNA sequencing technology in the last 20 years that people have been able to look at these things in a proper scientific way. There's been a lot of speculation, obviously, for hundreds of years about how people are related to each other and are we all members of the same species, and if so, when did we start to separate and are there really races and so on. So there was a lot of speculation early on, and, you know, there still is a fair amount. You know, people will look at bones, and some anthropologists will think, well, this proves that people evolved, you know, separately in East Asia or wherever it might be. But it was really beginning in the 1950s and 60s that geneticists started to enter the fray. And they were looking at blood groups because it wasn't possible to really work with DNA in those days. And the blood groups told them, yeah, there probably are some similarities between different populations, but we don't know the timing of these divergences. So really it was DNA technology, and in particular spin-offs from the Human Genome Project in the last 10 or 15 years that's allowed us to start to get at the dates of these events and how recently we share a common ancestry and where that ancestry is. It turns out we all were living in Africa as recently as 60,000 years ago. So it's really only in the last 2,000 human generations, which is the blink of an eye. In an evolutionary.
It is a blink of an eye. I had no idea it was that recent.
Yeah. So it's really only in that short span of time that people have started to scatter to the wind around the world and generate the patterns of physical diversity that we see today.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask that your phone line is a little bad here, and I want to hear every word you're saying. So we're just going to call you back briefly on another phone line and make sure that we can hear crystal clear. Spencer Wells is our guest this hour. He is the Genographic Project Director, and you see him featured on the National Geographic Special, which is going to air this coming Sunday night on that channel, which looked at the DNA of a couple hundred people in a neighborhood in Queens, all very interesting people, and found out how their ancestors made their way, eventually to Queens over a period of 60,000 years. And because of the work of Spencer and others who were in this field, we're able to trace that now through DNA. So you can get your swab and sign up for this if you want, which I think is a terrific idea. Wouldn't it be something to know? And it's amazing, the results from the people, because they found out that people they had been at war with shared the same DNA many, many years ago. Some people found out that their family had been Ashkenazi Jews for a long time. No idea that that was the case. And so it's all pretty interesting. All right, so we're going back. There we go. I can hear it's better already. 60,000 years. And tell me about how you know from a DNA swab. That's the thing that astounded me with these people that you talked to and worked with in Queens. How were you able to go back that far? What is the process?
Well, what we study are things called genetic markers. And these are tiny changes that occur from time to time as your DNA is being copied to be passed down through the generations. So you got your DNA from your parents, they got theirs from their parents, and so on. It's a lineage going back in time through the generations. And as the DNA is being copied in every generation, occasionally a typo will occur. It's like copying a long text by hand, and you'll occasionally substitute an I for an E. And at the DNA level, these are called mutations. So when these happen and they get passed down through the generations, they become markers of descent. They're just kind of ancestral baggage that we carry along with us. If you share one of these markers with another person, it means you share an ancestor at some point in the past, the person who first had that change in their DNA. And by looking at the pattern of markers in people from around the world, we can reconstruct a family tree for everybody alive today.
Hmm. And you also trace all the ways that people got here, the patterns that they took. They came out of Africa. Everybody came out of Africa, but some of them went through India. The world was very different there. Some came through the Bering Straits. People came here in many different ways many years ago, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, once we started to expand in Africa and move out of Africa starting around 60,000 years ago, there were different migratory routes, an early coastal migration following the coastline of South Asia down through India, Southeast Asia, reaching Australia by around 50,000 years ago. A later migration up through the Middle East and moving into Central Asia roughly 40,000 years ago. Splitting off and turning left, moving into Europe around 35,000 years ago, and a small group moving north and east into Siberia and crossing into the Americas within the last 20,000 years. So, you know, the different migratory routes intersect at these various points in the past, and we can see that through the pattern of markers.
Why did we leave Africa?
Well, not everybody did. Most people, in fact, stayed on in Africa. It was just a very small group that moved out. It was probably due to a population expansion. And so these journeys weren't people setting out to conquer the world. They were simply, you know, individuals looking over a hill and seeing that there were grasslands beyond and animals to hunt and so on, and moving a little bit further every generation. And so, you know, it was more of a trickle rather than a fire hose of migration out of Africa.
Mm-hmm. And what did climate change have to do with all of this?
Well, so many of these events, and this is recent data, it's really come out of the, you know, getting a better grip on the timing of these events. So many of these migratory events seem to coincide with major climatic shifts. So, you know, we're heading into an ice age, or there's the eruption of a massive volcano, or the climate in Africa shifts so that the Sahara is green. A lot of these migrations are, you know, perfectly coincidental with these climate change events. And so, you know, we as geneticists study the who, where, and when the ancient migratory routes, but to get at the how and the why, which is really kind of the interesting stuff, we have to look at other fields. And so piecing this together, it seems more and more that the climate was a major factor in where people moved and when.
And allowed people to get to certain places during those years that we couldn't do now because they could walk there, right?
Yeah,
it took a long time to get there.
The best example would be the Bering Land Bridge that joined Alaska to Siberia between 15 and 20,000 years ago during the last glacial maximum. You know, that allowed people to literally walk from one continent to another, which, of course, you can't really do today unless the sea is frozen perfectly and you're lucky. I mean, people have tried it, certainly. But basically, I mean, as hunter-gatherers, you wouldn't have been setting out to do this, to cross that great chasm. Rather, it was just, again, people wandering into new territory. And so, you know, climate can be a carrot and a stick in these migratory events. It can open up new possibilities or it can also force you on.
And tell us about what I think you call the longest trek in human history, where people made their way across that strait all the way to the bottom of South America.
Yeah, it's amazing if you think about it. I mean, imagine walking out of Africa, you and your descendants. You start up in, say, the Rift Valley in Kenya or Tanzania, and you wander out into the Middle East, and then you cruise north of the Pamir Mountains in Central Asia, and then you wander up around Lake Baikal in Siberia, and you keep going east and north, and it's an ice age, and the temperatures can be as low as minus 100 degrees in the winter, and then you wander across into present-day Alaska, and then you head south and wander down through Mexico and Guatemala and end up at Tierra del Fuego. I mean, that is a long journey.
Right. Why would you go that far?
Well, again, it's probably the same reason that people move today. It's simple decisions, you know, lack of opportunity at home, perception that there's a better opportunity elsewhere. And once you make it down into the Americas beyond the ice, you know, we're the only hominid species living there. We had horses living in the Americas at that time. We probably drove them to extinction, and they were extinct here until the Spaniards arrived many millennia later. So, you know, it was a wonderful place to live and lots of game, and the population probably just exploded.
And then some of those people at the very tip of South America went to the Caribbean?
Well, the people in the northern part of South America, so present-day Venezuela and Guyana and places like that.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about, because they're such fascinating people, how you chose the people who are going to be part of this project, what Queens neighborhood, why you chose Queens, and some of the more, well, they're all fascinating, but some of the stories that were so dramatic that people couldn't believe the results.
Well, as you said, you know, it was an experiment. In my first book, The Journey of Man, I talked about the idea that people are moving around and mixing to a much greater extent today than we ever have. And, you know, I speculated that it might be possible in, you know, a single location in a city like New York, one of these melting pot cities, to sample all the world's major genetic lineages. And so we basically wanted to do that experiment. And to slant the odds in our favor, if you will, we went to the most mixed part of New York, which is Queens. And you've got people speaking more than 150 different languages, and more than half the population is foreign-born. And so what we wanted to do was, you know, at a street fair on a single day when people are walking around in the street, take a random sample of a couple of hundred individuals and see if we could tell this story, the story of all of us from that one group of people. And we could.
And what surprised you about what you found? What surprised the people about what they found when you gave them the results?
Well, you know, there's some great stories in the show, and I really hope that people will tune in and get the messages. Sorry?
Yeah, I hope so, too. It's a great show.
Yeah, you know, Michelle DeJesus is a great example. She is a Puerto Rican-American, and, you know, as far as she knows, she is simply Puerto Rican. She knows that perhaps she might have some Spanish ancestry or whatever, but she really doesn't know that much about her family history beyond a few generations. And her genetic results showed that she is actually carrying one of these founding lineages that made it into the Americas across the Bering Land Bridge 15 to 20,000 years ago. So she has a connection to the indigenous peoples of the Americas that she never realized. And it's caused her to kind of reevaluate her sense of who she is and her ancestry.
I was struck. You had some of the people whose ancient ancestors were musical, or they were artistic, or they were incredible travelers, as she was, and she's a runner. I was interested in whether or not any of those genes that we carry go back so far, and if we reawaken them because we have them, we've got one that may make us artistically talented or musically talented or have great fortitude.
It is conceivable, certainly. I mean, we don't know that much about the genetics of these traits and to what extent they even are genetic. But, yeah, there probably is some genetic variation in things like artistic ability and certainly in things like perfect pitch, you know, which would play into musical ability. You know, it's likely that a lot of these traits arose 50 to 60,000 years ago as our ancestors were starting to experiment with art and were sitting around the campfire telling more complex stories and complex language, syntactic language that we're using now, subject, verb, object, probably arose around that time. You know, so a lot of these characteristics probably do date back quite a long time.
Tell me about the encounter with the Neanderthals.
Well, modern Europeans arrived on the scene about 35,000 years ago. The Cro-Magnon people, the people who left the amazing cave art at places like Chauvet and Lascaux. And they encountered the Neanderthals who were living in Europe at the time. They were our cousins. We share an ancestor with Neanderthals around 500,000 years ago, again back in Africa. They were part of an earlier migration. But they're not our ancestors, basically. Modern Europeans are not descended from Neanderthals, it turns out, from the genetic data. So we wandered into Europe around 35,000 years ago, saw them. They'd been living there for a couple of 100,000 years, were very successful. And they'd adapted to life in that very cold climate. Again, this was during an ice age. And were adapted the hunting methods that you needed. And, they had a simple kind of thrusting spear motion that they would go through in all likelihood and hide behind trees. And it was mostly short-range hunting. And as we moved in, we had these really amazingly adapted hunting methods that we had developed out in the steppes of Central Asia. And we were highly adapted to hunting in areas that were not forested. And when we arrived, it turned out that the climate was shifting in such a way that these forests that the Neanderthals had adapted to were disappearing. And so the combination of having us on the scene, so highly adapted to these new ecosystems that were appearing in Europe at that time, and probably population pressure, our population, modern humans, was probably expanding. We were probably eating a lot more game. We basically drove them to extinction within a few thousand years. Hmm.
Can you imagine that moment when people first encountered them? You wonder what they were thinking.
I know. Just imagine that today, if you wandered into some new place, some, you know, previously unknown island in the South Pacific or whatever it might have been, and you came face to face with somebody who looked like you, that acted very differently, and you could tell that you were related, perhaps, but quite different. It must have been an amazing moment.
It must have been. And tell us what you've learned about, because there's such minor things in all of this, differences in our skin color, differences in our eyes. Did that happen as a result of this, as a response to different climates?
Yeah, so many of these features that we think of as being so deep-seated, as defining races, if you will, are really only skin deep. And often the reason they're on the surface is because they are surface adaptations to the place where we're living. So skin color is the best example. It's the one everybody wants to know about, of course, because it's been so important historically. We evolved in Africa, as we've been talking about, and we are a hairless species of primate that evolved on the savannas of eastern Africa. So we're exposed to a lot of sun in Africa. Africa's the most tropical continent on Earth. And we didn't have SPF 30 sun cream 70,000 years ago. So we had to have a natural way of protecting our skin from all that intense sunlight. And so there's a lot of melanin in the skin of people living around the tropics, including, of course, in Africans. So we started off dark as a means of protecting ourselves from the sun. Now, as we moved north and out of Africa into the higher latitudes, into places like Central Asia and Europe, we actually had to lose some of that pigmentation because it turns out you have to allow a little bit of the UV rays through to the deeper layers of your skin so that you can synthesize vitamin D. Most of the vitamin D that we get, until we started supplementing our diets with it, of course, most of the vitamin D came from synthesizing it in ourselves, in our own bodies. So we had to lose some of that pigmentation because we were wearing heavy clothes and we didn't get as much sun because it was cloudier up in the high latitudes. So our skin became lighter. We were adapting to the climate.
And what about our eyes, differences in our eyes?
Well, the eyes, some people believe that, say, the epicanthic fold in East Asians, that extra layer of skin above the eyes, might have been an adaptation to cold climate out in the steppes. Maybe it allowed them to, you know, survive in snowy conditions. It protected their eyes. The jury is out on that. A lot of the variation in human appearance probably also has to do with a force that Darwin called sexual selection. And this he described in a book in 1871, he basically said, well, you know, the people we mate with are the people we find attractive, and that varies according to where you are in the world, and you can have tiny little changes that are accentuated over time simply because of regional variation. And so, you know, that probably also played a big role in these minor characteristics, not things like skin color, but, say, hair type or the shape of the nose or whatever it might have been.
Mm-hmm. The thing that was, the whole thing is astounding, but the thing that was so remarkable to me was this really strong sense of common humanity. You put all the people in a park and put the map of the world there and put them in their different areas, and then eventually they all became one. But people who, when you talk about the young woman from Puerto Rico, you had, by appearances, African-American male who thought of himself, his ancestors as coming from Africa, from Ghana, I believe. You've got somebody from Turkey who discovers that you know, it's Ashkenazi Jews who are in his background. The African-American has a lot of Europeans in his background. Tell me about some of those responses, because it really does change your perception of who you are.
Yeah, it does. I mean, you mentioned the African-American guy, Dave Reed, who turned out to have a Y chromosome that was European. That's actually not that uncommon among African-American men. Around 30-35% of African-American men are carrying European Y chromosomes, and these were probably introduced to their lineage during the slave trading era in the last few hundred years. But, you know, yes, it does, I suppose, cause you to reevaluate your sense of who you are. If you had always heard, we just came from Ghana or we just came from West Africa, and then you discover you have European roots as well, you know, it doesn't change your perception of being African-American. Race is a very complex thing, and you know, perceptions of what race you belong to have to do with a lot of social factors. It's not just about your DNA. But it does cause you to expand your sense of, you know, the tribe or the group that you belong to. And so, yeah, we did get some very interesting responses from people.
You also had people who said, well, I want our parents to see this because we'd like to get married, and our parents are not in favor of this because we look differently.
Yes, yes. We had an Irish musician who had been dating a Korean woman for several years, and her parents were opposed to the marriage because they were from different groups, different families or different tribes or races. And he was hoping that the fact that they do share common ancestry at some point would cause them to change their minds.
We're going to welcome phone calls. We have one line open if you'd like to join us. The number is 800-486-8655. Our guest is Spencer Wells, Genographic Project Director. He's a really key part of this, the Human Family Tree, on the National Geographic Channel. It's premiering this coming Sunday at 8 o'clock our time. You may be familiar with another big work that he did. He's done a lot of big work, but he was also the creator of The Journey of Man, A Genetic Odyssey, which was an award-winning book and also documentary that aired on PBS internationally. It chronicled his globe-circling DNA-gathering expeditions in 2001-2002 and laid the groundwork for the Genographic Project. And he's now very, very much involved with this latest project. He is explorer. Isn't that a great title? I'm the explorer in residence at the National Geographic Society. It indeed is a cool job. To your phone calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Oh, the email is talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now and start with Roddy from Milwaukee. Hello.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi, I have a question. I did the project about 2 years ago. My wife and I participated in it, and we tried, and it was very interesting. But I just have two questions. On the Cradle of Humanity, which the professor says is out of East Africa, starting 60,000 years ago, is there a possibility there were other centers or other cradles in, say, Asia or, say, North America? Or is this strictly the only cradle of humanity? And the other question is, for example, I always have this question on as far as the environmental factors. Why do people, say, in Northern Europe, Norway, et cetera, have blonde hair and blue eyes, as whereas the Eskimos have black hair and usually dark eyes? And if, I guess because of the environmental factor, the cold and all of that, I mean, I was wondering how that would affect that and why the difference in Northern Europe and the Eskimos.
Very good questions. Could there have been other cradles of humanity? Well, what's clear is that there have been multiple migrations out of Africa. You know, it's happened time after time. In fact, going all the way back to the great apes, Africa is where the great apes originated around 23 million years ago, according to the fossil record. And it was actually disconnected from Eurasia at that point, floating around due to plate tectonics, and it bumped into Eurasia about 16 million years ago. And apes started to leave at that time, and the ones that ended up in Southeast Asia became the gibbons and the orangs, and the ones that stayed behind evolved into the gorillas and the chimps and us. So there have been these multiple migrations during the time of Homo erectus. About 2 million years ago, there was a migration. Ancient Homo sapiens, archaic Homo heidelbergensis, whatever you want to call it, there's some disagreement on the exact name, but there was a migration of the ancestors of the Neanderthals about 500,000 years ago. And then finally, there's us. What's clear is that everybody alive today descends from that group of Africans. So everybody alive today, no matter where you are in the world, traces their ancestry back to Africa within the last 60,000 years. So if there was anybody else out there, they're not our ancestors.
Oh.
We descend from that group of Africans. So we don't descend from
the Homo erectus who were living in Asia at the time that we wandered in. We don't descend from the Neanderthals who were living in Europe at the time we wandered in. We drove them to extinction, or they went extinct at the same time. But we descend from that group of Africans living 60,000 years ago on that continent. Huh. Now, in terms of the physical features, it's a good question. We really don't know exactly what genes control all of these physical characteristics. It's a subject of a lot of research at the moment. As to why Europeans have lighter hair and more variation in hair type and hair color than East Asians, we're not sure. What we do know is that the history of East Asia is relatively recent, and one event in particular, the development of rice agriculture about 10,000 years ago, has had a huge impact on the gene pool of East Asia. And so you have a population that originated probably in southern China, first developed rice agriculture there, and they literally expanded all over East Asia, up into Korea, up into Japan, down into Southeast Asia. And as they spread, they probably spread their physical appearance with them. So, you know, that is one reason why the hair types in East Asia are very uniform, as opposed to Europe. So, but apart from that, we don't really know. And, you know, watch this space. We're hoping to find out over the coming years.
I'm sure you will. Did you learn anything extraordinary about yourself, Roddy?
Well, it was interesting how we migrated out of Africa, and then my ancestors went through Turkey, and then according to the professors, they went through Northern Europe, and then they dropped down. And then my wife's side, but my question is on the X and Y chromosomes. How come, like, say, for the male, when I sent in my sample, they only did the X chromosome, or I'm sorry, the Y chromosome, and for my wife, they did just the X chromosome? Couldn't they do both, like mother and fathers at the same time? Or it was just one, the male lineage did the male lineage, and I couldn't do my mother's side. I had to do it through my sister. Mm. So she had to do the female side. I was just questioning why they did it that way.
Sure.
Well, it's a good question. So you're talking about the Y chromosome, which is the piece of DNA that makes men men. So only men have it, and they get it from their father. So it traces a purely paternal line of descent. Men also have mitochondrial DNA. It's not the X chromosome we're looking at. It's a piece of DNA known as mitochondrial DNA, and it is passed down through the female line. So everybody carries it, but you only get it from your mother, and only mothers pass it on. So it traces a purely maternal line of descent. Men can choose to do either one. Either do your father's side or your mother's side. Women, because, of course, they don't have the Y chromosome, can't do the Y. They can't look at their father's line. They have to get a brother to get tested or their father himself.
Hmm. Thanks very much for the call. Let's go next to Barun from Madison. Hi, Barun.
Yeah, hi. I had two questions. The first one was, how exactly do you trace the a particular genetic marker to a geographic region? And my second question was, I'm assuming that there would be, or I guess the entire population on Earth is a result of maybe inbreeding, you know, from that initial population. And, you know, was there still an incidence of mental or physical anomalies back in that period, too, as it is now, as a result of inbreeding? And I can take my comments off the air.
Answer off the air. Sure, thanks.
Okay, so, yeah, very good questions again. How do we trace the geographic origin of markers? Well, what we do is we look at a database of people from around the world, and that is really the focus of Genographic, is we've got all these research centers, 12 of them set up all over the globe, established population geneticists, and they're charged with sampling primarily indigenous and traditional people from their region of the world, so South America, Sub-Saharan Africa, the Middle East and North Africa, and so on. The idea is that these are people who've lived in the same place for a long period of time, and they retain a link to their geography that most of the rest of us have lost. I have ancestors from all over Northern and Western Europe, and I live in Washington, D.C. What does my DNA tell you about the history of North America or even any particular part of Europe? It's hard to say. But there are people who've lived in the same place for thousands, even tens of thousands of years, and they give us a glimpse of what their ancestors' genetic patterns would have looked like. And so by looking at the distribution of these lineages in people from around the world and the accumulated level of variation, we can actually pinpoint where these lineages originated. So the haplogroups, a set of markers that define your lineage, we can actually pinpoint where those haplogroups originated. Now, in terms of the inbreeding, yes, absolutely. We're highly inbred. As a species of large primate, we have, you know, about a quarter of the level of genetic variation of most other species of large primate, chimps and gorillas and orangs. We think of them as being close to extinction, but in fact, we were very close to extinction about 70,000 years ago. The total human population, which at that point was limited only to Africa, probably dropped as low as 2,000 people. We were hanging on by our fingertips, and we came back from that, and we became smarter, and that is why we've been able to expand, and, you know, there are nearly 7 billion of us around the globe today, but we still retain that palimpsest, that glimpse of that inbreeding that happened 70,000 years ago. Wow. So in terms of genetic disease, you know, we don't know what the level of genetic disease would have been prior to that bottleneck event 70,000 years ago. Maybe it was lower. Maybe it was the same. It's impossible to say. But what's clear is today, what's clear today, rather, is that we are very, very closely related at the DNA level, 99.9% identical, and that's a result of that bottleneck event.
We were down to 2,000.
Yeah, believe it or not.
Isn't that something?
Yeah,
so we can all feel pretty good about the fact that we're survivors. We're strong,
we're survivors.
We're survivors.
We were that close.
Yeah. Isn't that something? Thanks very much for the call. We go to Gary next. Hi, Gary.
Hi, I got a question. Great show, by the way. To me, it seems counterintuitive that early man in Eastern Asia with agriculture and rice would migrate north to a much more hostile and barren and frigid environment and cross the Bering Straits during the middle of an ice age. What's your thoughts on
that?
Yeah,
that's a good question.
Yeah, the migration across the Bering Land Bridge happened just prior to the development of agriculture, but probably, we were living as hunter-gatherers around that time, probably it was still population pressure that led people to move up into those regions. And although, yeah, it's really cold there, once you figure out ways to cope with the cold, you develop warm clothing and portable shelters and so on that the Eskimos use, once you figure out how to do that, you're actually living in a giant meat locker. You know, you've got caribou, you've got elk, you've got all these other things. And there's a lot of food to eat. And so, you know, it probably was a little bit of population pressure initially forcing them up there. But once they got there, they were like, yeah, we're set. Okay, this is great.
I'm not sure I would have felt that way, but this is great. Oh, Gary's gone. Thanks, Gary, very much for your call. Let me give you the number again. Our lines have been crowded. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. And this hour, we're having a fascinating hour talking about the National Geographic special airing this Sunday at 8 o'clock, the world premiere of The Human Family Tree. And it's because of the work of Spencer, our guest, that this is on the air because of the work that he's done. Tell me just a little bit, because I'm sure you have 100 million fascinating stories here, but in order to do this program, you really had to travel all over the world. You've gone to some extremely remote parts of this world, haven't you?
Yeah, I've got a few frequent flyer miles.
I'll bet you do. Where did you go and why did you have to go there?
Well, you know, we wanted to get out in the field and tell the stories and kind of try to imagine what life would have been like living in these places for our ancestors. So, you know, we went down to southern and eastern Africa and worked with some hunter-gatherer groups living there, like the San Bushmen and the Hadzabe of Tanzania. We wanted to see what it might have been like in India. If there was an early human population there, what happened to them after this giant volcanic eruption 74,000 years ago that probably would have decimated the population? We wanted to get down into Southeast Asia, and we went to the Philippines in particular to look at a very interesting population, the Aita, a group of what the early Spanish conquerors called the Negrito populations in Southeast Asia, people who look basically like African pygmies, and they're living in this mix of people who look much more East Asian, and they probably retain a direct genetic link and certainly a physical link back to the very earliest inhabitants of Southeast Asia. So, yeah, I mean, we basically wanted to get out in the field and, in addition to telling the stories of the people from Queens, kind of put them in context, the global context of all these ancient migrations.
Mm. And where does all of this take you next?
Well, we continue to publish scientific papers right and left. I mean, I've just received a manuscript from on my email from our principal investigator, the person who runs our regional center in East Asia, and he's got something on the origin of the Tibetans. So, you know, lots of amazing stories that are going to be coming out over the next several years as we start to analyze the data that we've been producing.
Mm-hmm. And what is the broader, this idea that we all came from the same place, I'm wondering what the broader implications are of all that you're doing. Does it eventually, do you hope, lessen racial tensions? Does it make us more aware of the genetic traits that we share, the DNA that we share, so we're less likely to go to war? Or am I overstating everything?
It would be nice if that were the case. Yeah, if people could take away the social message that we are members of an extended family and that by hurting somebody else, we're hurting a member of our family, that would be fantastic. You know, obviously I'm a scientist. I want to tell people about the exciting science we're doing and fill in the details of human history and ancient migrations. But, you know, to the extent that there is a broader social message, that would be it.
John from Madison, hi.
Hi. We coexisted with the neanderthal for tens of thousands of years, and I've read that the DNA analysis indicates that we didn't interbreed with the neanderthal, which strikes me as strange. I just wondered how sure we are of that fact. And my other question is, there was a small breed of extinct humanoid found in an Indonesian island, and they think it's possibly a Homo erectus descendant, and I wonder what your feelings were on this.
Okay, good question. So we coexisted with the Neanderthals probably for 5,000 to 10,000 years, possibly. And why didn't we interbreed with them? Well, you know, we probably tried. You know, it's something that humans do. They move into a new area, and, you know, we start trying to mix up the gene pool. You know, maybe we didn't, but I think it's likely that someone at some point over that long expanse of time would have tried. And probably the reason why there are no descendants of Neanderthals in modern humans is that we were incompatible. We'd been separated for too long. You know, 500,000 years is a long time. Maybe there was a difference in chromosome number. Maybe there were genes that were incompatible with each other. You know, that would be my interpretation. We don't know the answer. But that's my speculative guess. And, you know, what is clear, as you said, is that the genetic data shows that all Europeans are the descendants of that same group of people who left Africa 60,000 years ago and not the descendants of the Neanderthals. So that's incredibly clear. In terms of these groups from Southeast Asia, you're talking about the hobbits that have been covered in the mass media quite a bit. Very interesting, small people, 3 feet tall or so. And, you know, there's been a lot of speculation as to whether they were diseased modern humans, people with some sort of genetic disorder, or maybe they were a separate species. The consensus seems to be now that they are a separate species, perhaps even different from Erectus. And again, we don't know the final answer on this. But yeah, they're probably the remnant of this earlier migration that came out of Africa, as I said, roughly 2 million years ago. And they stuck around in Southeast Asia, and we encountered them, and probably in the same way that the Neanderthals went extinct, they went extinct soon after we arrived.
Thank you, John. Sarah from Racine, hi.
Hi. I actually have a question about gender. I feel like we're hearing in the news lately about intersexed people and people who, you know, there's the South African runner who's being questioned about her gender. And I'm wondering if both in your research for this thing you did in Queens, if you saw revealed any gender variance in people, and also if we're seeing that's still changing or what's going on with that.
Okay, I'm not sure exactly what you're asking, but in terms of gender, you know, we're looking at pieces of DNA that tell us about particular lines of descent. So either your mother's 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 mother, your father's 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 father. In general, the stories agree, certainly over a very long time span, so when we left Africa and where we went first and when we came into the Americas. Over more recent time spans, i.e., you know, the last few thousand years or the last few hundred years even, we can see very different patterns sometimes for the Y chromosome, the male side and the female side. In part, that's because, surprisingly, perhaps women tend to move around more regionally than men do, and that is because in most patrilocal human societies, which is the majority of human societies, the men define group membership. So think about, you know, the European habit of women changing their names when they get married to their husband's name. What you're doing is you're joining your husband's clan. And that literally is what you used to do. You would leave your father's clan behind and move out, you know, and move in with your husband's. And you would take on the attributes of their clan. And so you've got mitochondrial DNA types constantly being introduced into populations and moved around, whereas the Y chromosomes, the male lines, tend to stay put. So in that case, we can see quite different patterns sometimes looking at the Y and the MT DNA. In terms of the intersex question and all that, we're not really studying that. So it's not what we focus on. But we do see these gender bias patterns of migration in some cases.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Sarah, for your call. Bonnie from Madison. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi. I was wondering if you or other researchers have found out where the Basque in Spain and the Hmong originally came from, because I think some of their, or other groups such as them, who don't share a lot of the cultural context of the people they're geographically living with, and they've been seen as outsiders. Have you found any ideas from where they came or why they were pushed out?
The Basques. Yes, everybody's fascinated by the Basques, and rightfully so, because they speak a language that is so different from Spanish or French, the languages that are spoken around them. In fact, it's unrelated to any other language on Earth. There may be some tenuous connection to languages spoken in the Caucasus. in the Middle East, but basically they speak a linguistic isolate, as it's called, in the linguistics community. Genetically, though, they're basically identical, very, very similar to the surrounding Spanish population. So we actually have a paper that we're working on at the moment that's going to be analyzing this with the largest collection of Basque samples ever obtained. But basically, the Basques look like the Spaniards. So the reason why their language is so different, we don't know. It's probably retained from some point much earlier. Whether that is, you know, the Paleolithic, the earliest people to move into Europe 35,000 years ago, or whether that was perhaps sometime after the development of agriculture and its introduction from the Middle East, we don't know. But it's probably a remnant of a much older language. And we know certainly that the languages derived from Latin, the Romance languages, have only moved into Western Europe in the last 1,500 years or so with the spread of the Roman Empire. So, yeah, it's a really interesting language, fascinating to study the cultural attributes of the Basques, but genetically, they're basically Spanish.
Thank you very much, Bonnie, for your call. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. The number is 800-486-8655. Spencer Wells is our guest, geneticist, anthropologist, explorer in residence at the National Geographic Society, and he is featured, his work is featured in the Human Family Tree, the National Geographic special that will be on this Sunday, 8 o'clock Central Time, and well worth your viewing. He is a leading population geneticist, and he has also authored the book A Journey of Man, A Genetic Odyssey, which won a lot of awards and also was made into a documentary that aired on PBS back in 2001. He began his field studies in earnest in 1996 with a survey of Central Asia and then expanded their study to include some 25,000 miles of Asia in the former Soviet republics. His research and its landmark research findings have led to advances in the understanding of the male Y chromosome and its ability to trace ancestral human migration. And this particular documentary took 200 people in Queens, which may be the most diverse place on Earth, and traced their, you know, did the DNA swab. Oh, I got to ask him how we can all do that. And the findings are truly remarkable. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program, we'll be speaking with well-known author Dean Koontz, who's written his first nonfiction work about his dog, Trixie. Back to phone calls now for Spencer. Jennifer from Green Bay, hello.
Hi. This is kind of going to be kind of weird because I'm kind of an archaeologist myself. But I was wondering if you could speak to the fact that archaeologists and gene people have discovered that the gene for like red hair in people is older than Homo erectus, and also to Florensis being possibly tiny because they're on a tiny little island with pygmy elephants.
Completely different questions, but I'll certainly try. One of the main genes that controls red hair color, and there actually are multiple ones, but the main one is known as melanocortin receptor, MC1R, and there are multiple mutations that are associated with red hair. I'm carrying one of them. Even though I have blonde hair, you have to have two copies to actually have red hair, and I have a daughter. This isn't in the film. We did film it, and it's available on the web. If you want to find out more about this, go to the website for the film. But I have a daughter who has red hair because her mother is also carrying one copy. Basically the two line up in the same individual 25% of the time. And so this melanocortin receptor has mutated multiple times, and it's all happened within the lifetime of modern humans. Neanderthals seem to have had other mutations in the melanocortin receptor that conferred red hair, and so probably there were some redheaded Neanderthals wandering around. But again, they were separate mutations. It's not that we've retained this for, 500,000 or a million years. And in terms of the dwarfism, it is a fairly common thing on islands, that species that are introduced to islands will become smaller in stature. So there are pygmy elephants and so on. So it's perhaps not so surprising that Homo erectus or whatever the species was that was introduced to this island down in Southeast Asia, the hobbits, it's not surprising perhaps that these individuals became smaller over time. It probably has to do with limiting resources on islands. You get up to a certain population size and your absolute carrying capacity, and there would be selection for people to get smaller because, in effect, you'd have more kids eating the same amount of food. So it is something we see in biology over and over again.
I always told my mother-in-law that if we have a kid with red hair, I am blaming her.
Okay.
Thanks, Jennifer, for your call. Fred from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I was wondering if your guest is aware of any close genetic connection between Middle Eastern Jews and Palestinians.
The connection between Jews and Palestinians, yes, absolutely, a very clear connection. So Middle Eastern Jews in particular, the Mizrahi Jews, as they're called, basically share the same gene pool as the non-Jewish Middle Eastern populations. And it's not too surprising. I mean, the religions have only come in, you know, Islam and then Judaism and later Christianity relatively recently in the grand scheme of things, only in the last couple of thousand years. So, you know, it's not too surprising that you're sampling people from the same gene pool. What's clear is that Ashkenazi Jews, for instance, the European Jews, or Eastern European Jews, did kind of take on genetic lineages from the surrounding European population during the diaspora. So you see additional European lineages showing up in those Jewish populations. But the Middle Eastern Jews, yes, are very similar to other Middle Eastern populations.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. And who was the young man who discovered that many of his ancestors were Ashkenazi Jews and he had no idea he had any Jewish lineage at all?
Well, no, he didn't discover that they were Jewish. What he discovered is that he belonged to a haplogroup, a lineage that has a lot of Jews that are members. So certainly there's a relationship there, but again, it probably traces back to the Middle East and not specifically to a Jewish population.
I see. Let's go next to Gina from Madison. Hi, Gina.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah. Hi. I just had a quick question. I like to read stuff from the BBC website. They report on all kinds of things, and there was a people discovered in Brazil that had been isolated for probably thousands of years, a prehistoric people. And I was wondering if you knew anything about that and if there was any more information. I've done, like, a light Google search but never found anything.
Well, there actually are a fair number of what they call uncontacted tribes in the Brazilian Amazon. We don't know exactly how many because, obviously, you know, we haven't contacted them, but they estimate there are probably a few dozen that have no idea that there is a 21st century and that Europeans conquered Brazil 500 years ago.
Oh, my.
So, you know, there are several of these groups, and there was a picture taken recently that I think some people accuse them of being fraudulent or something like that. But anyway, I'm not sure which group you're talking about in particular, but yes, there are certainly uncontacted groups in Brazil, and it's thought that there are probably some in New Guinea and Irian Jaya as well.
Hmm. Well, there would be another assignment for you.
Well, I'm actually hoping to go to New Guinea early next year.
So. Somehow that doesn't surprise me. Before I forget, how do you get to the website for the documentary, The Human Tree? And also, how do you sign up to have your DNA swapped?
Okay, so the easiest way to get to the website for the Human Family Tree is just to Google Human Family Tree. Let me pull it up because it's quite long. So it would be channel.nationalgeographic.com/channel/human-family-tree. So just Google Human Family
Tree. Right, okay.
But for our website for the project, it's genographic.com, genographic.com. And you can find out about what we're doing and the science we use. And you can even order a kit and swab your own cheek and get yourself tested.
Great. I'm with you. Sign me up.
I would. Okay.
Okay. Thanks very much, Gina, for the call. We go to Ron next from Grafton. Hi, Ron, and we're running short on time.
Okay. I'm a participant in the Genographic Project. I'm a Polish ancestry, J2, though. But my question has to do with the relationship of the Celts and the Germans, because there were supposedly a large population of Celts, and all of a sudden the Germans came in, and I think most Germans might have Celtic ancestry.
Possibly. I mean, the Celts certainly originated in present-day Germany, Austria, that region, the Hallstatt culture, for instance, and spread westward during the first millennium B.C., and that coincided roughly with the Germanic migration. So the two may have had something to do with each other. You know, does that mean that the Germans are Celtic or vice versa? Yeah, a little bit of both. You know, they probably do ultimately come from the same source population, the same region.
Hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Ron, for the call. You do have one of the coolest jobs on Earth, don't you?
I'm very lucky. You know, as you were laughing about the title Explorer in Residence, it is kind of an oxymoron, but it's a great gig. Yeah, I'm very lucky.
It is a great gig, and you've done extraordinary work. It's almost as though you were meant to be alive at this time in history, isn't it? So you could do what you're doing.
So I'm lucky to be alive when we have the tools to start to answer some of these questions. You know, it would be a terrible thing to be curious about this stuff and not be able to answer the questions. But it's great to actually have the tools of modern molecular genetics and to be able to go out and apply them to these questions.
Well, I'm glad you're doing it. Thank you, Spencer, so much for being with us.
Thanks a lot, Kathleen. It's been great.
Spencer Wells, geneticist, anthropologist, explorer in residence at the National Geographic Society. We're talking about the wonderful documentary airing this Sunday at 8 o'clock, The Human Family Tree. It's a world premiere. It's narrated by Kevin Bacon. And what they did was take a couple hundred people from a single street in Queens and trace their ancestral footsteps. And it turns out there you are, the ancestral footsteps of all humanity. If you'd like to get more information about getting one of these kits so you can find out from where you came, it is genographic.com, simple GENOGRAPHIC.com. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for getting her eyes on this and booking this show. Wasn't it good? You were such interesting callers, too. And thanks to Rhonda for doing on-air production as well. News is coming up from National Public Radio, and we'll be back with another hour of Thursday conversation on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.